Welcome to Civics and Coffee. My name is Alicia, and I am a self-professed history nerd. Each week, I'm going to chat about a topic on U.S. history and give you both the highlights and occasionally break down some of the complexities in history and share stories you may not remember learning in high school, all in the time it takes to enjoy a cup of coffee. Hey peeps, welcome back. A couple of weeks ago, I hosted Michael Trapani. He is the host of the podcast How to Start a War, which looks at the events leading up to World War II through the eyes of the quote-unquote bad actors. He recently turned the podcast into an audiobook and joined me in talking about the book, how economic policies fueled the start of World War II, and what went behind producing an audiobook. We held our conversation over Zoom, so I am inserting my standard sound quality warning here. Enjoy. Hey, everyone. With me today is fellow podcast host and new audiobook author, Michael Trapani. He is the host of the podcast, How to Start a War, which inspired the just-published audiobook of the same name, which will be the focus of our discussion today. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me. I got my coffee, so I'm ready to go.
Wonderful. So let's dive in. You start by saying you have power. What power do you feel people have to alter the world in which they live?
Yeah, that's an important question. I start the introduction with this phrase, you have power. And I think it's important to remind people of that because let's be honest, when you look around in the world today, I think it's pretty easy to feel defeated. It's like every 6 months, there's a new catastrophe that we're just waiting to happen. And so I think that, you know, while we live in a different, difficult world, it doesn't change the fact that we do have power. And what kind of power do we have? All the power in the world. I mean, anything that has ever been done throughout human history has been done by people, and people like you and me. Every time someone has changed the world, it was a person that did that. And I use the story of the rise of extremism in pre-World War II Germany and the events that led up to the war as an example of when power was available to good people to stop bad people, but they failed to use it when it could have been used to prevent the worst. And, you know, that worst, that crime of the century, as I refer to it, is World War II and the Holocaust, which was the single largest event of human death that human beings had ever inflicted upon the earth. So pretty bad consequences as it relates to not using power that we all have. And I think this was a good way to remind folks of that.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the podcast and the audiobook really focuses on that run-up to World War II. And one of the things that you mention is that history can help us understand our present. And I'm just curious, can you expand more on this and why you think it's an effective way to kind of contextualize larger moments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you say contextualize. I think context over a long enough period of time is history, yeah. Right? I mean, big things never happen out of nowhere, even though they sometimes seem that way. There's always background. Sometimes hundreds of years of context can explain why something happened. I mean, you could almost never go far back enough. I mean, think about every large moment in your life, right? Maybe you got married or you had kids or you got into a particular school or job or achieved something. I mean, how far back would you have to go to get to the so-called beginning of that story? You could probably go all the way back. and events of the world are no different, except the timelines are longer and they usually involve more people. So more stuff happens. And I think that's like a weakness of folks that, you know, I studied history and I had plenty of history professors and have worked with a lot of historians. And as important as just the facts, ma'am, is to understanding what actually happened, I do think that there is a huge missed opportunity about telling stories. And stories is how we learn the best as people. And there are no shortage of incredible stories that actually happened. And so I think that it's an excellent way to share that.
Yeah, I agree. And how does viewing World War II through the bad actors kind of provide a new understanding of the period?
Yeah, that's the premise of the book, is that you're looking at the criminals who caused the crime of the century to happen. You're following along with them in the events. And you know, World War II, at the end of the day, was caused by bad actors. And yes, there were terrible conditions that made the ground fertile for those bad actors to thrive. But sometimes I think, and I think a lot of us think, that the world runs on autopilot, right? And big things or events that happen around the world happen over there versus around us or with us. They happen to us, right? That's like a perspective that it's really easy to get. But no, right? So just like good things, bad things are caused by people. They're just people. They're horrible, extreme, villainous people, but they're people. And you know, I refer to World War II and the Holocaust of as the crime of the century, because that's what it was. And I think that if you have a crime of the century, you need to understand what the criminals did. You can't understand the crime without knowing what the criminals actually did. So I think that you know, it's really important to provide an understanding of that period. And it's really easy to look at things like, you know, D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge, and like a lot of the events that are very much through the perspective of our surroundings, especially myself based in the United States, right? We get World War II starting with Pearl Harbor and you know, D-Day and all that fun stuff. But you know, it started a lot earlier, and I think that understanding how those things were started by the people that started them tells us a lot more about how to prevent these things from happening in the future.
Yeah. And talking about kind of trying to find the origins of an event, one of the things you talk about is how some of the things in World War One led to or let kindling towards the start of World War II. So how did the economic penalties of World War One undercut the German government?
Oof, where do you start, right? if you think about the end of World War One, or at the time when it's referred to as the war, right? Because like, why would you call it anything else? Like, nothing that came before it would even look anything close to what had just happened. An entire generation was wiped off the face of the earth. More death at a rate that human beings had never seen before had just taken place. And the war ends in the same way that it began, and it was fought, like a frantic mess. It ends abruptly, and it turns out that the German Kaiser, who was running the country while it was at war and leading up to it, before World War One, didn't pay for anything. He funded the entire war effort through borrowing. And so he was really banking on the plan, on this idea of, well, you know, when we win, France and England will pay reparations to us, and that'll fund all the war, all the stuff that we just paid for. So you had war debts, you had reparations. And one of the things that happened to Germany after the war was the Treaty of Versailles and a number of other agreements that took place that effectively declawed and collapsed the German economy. As sort of a punishment, but also as a way to prevent these types of threats, this central power from rising again. Manufacturing was effectively shut down. Some of the areas of the country were seized completely or demilitarized, so that no military buildups could take place, no troops could be placed there. Territory was taken away from Germany and given to other countries. And there was really no economy to help support any sort of rebuild that would be able to pay back these reparations, let alone all the war debts that the country had. This and a few other things led to the largest hyperinflation event in modern history, the Weimar hyperinflation era. And to just give everyone a sense of context, a loaf of bread in 1921 in Germany cost about 160 marks, of the currency. So 160 marks in 1921. In 1923, at the height of hyperinflation, that same loaf of bread cost not 120 marks, but 500 billion marks. Right. So like, this is just an order of magnitude that no one could understand. As you can imagine, pensions were evaporated. Life savings were completely worthless. And you're talking to a population that had just been through the largest scale death event in their or anyone else's history and were being called the instigators of this war. You know, these are veterans who fought in the trenches who now don't have enough money to pay for food to feed their children. People began to starve. And it was at this time in the early 1920s that Hitler attempted his first revolution, if you will, which is the beer hall putsch. And it failed. It was a sort of radical event that he tried to overthrow the local government of Munich, the state government of Munich. So it'd be kind of like trying to overthrow like the New York state government or something, and then go from there to the capital, which was his plan, and to do that through like a violent insurrection. That was the plan, and it failed, and he was arrested and put in jail, and you know, there was that. And then during that time, as we know, this was the peak of hyperinflation, state of emergency, and all this stuff that was set. But a bunch of emergency actions were taken to stabilize the economy, stabilize the currency. A number of new economists were brought in to stabilize the currency. Huge amounts of loans coming in from the United States buoyed the German economy. The United States did extremely well post-war. And so they had a lot of money to lend. And just as all of that was starting to bolster the German economy, the stock market crash of 1929 happened, and all of those loans coming from the United States dried up, and the Great Depression began. And apart from the United States, which was the epicenter of the crash and the Great Depression, the only country to have it worse was Germany.
Yeah. And kind of sticking on that economic policy and its impact and influence, you know, we talked about how it influenced and undercut the German government, but can you talk about how the role of the economic policies kind of can influence the rise of anti-democratic regimes like those that we see in the lead up to World War II?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's to your point around undercutting the government. That's a huge part of this. There was this narrative, I think in today's parlance, we would refer to it as fake news, where it basically refers to, and I say this because it was the far right nationalist parties that perpetuated this narrative, that at the end of World War I, that the German army was actually on the verge of winning. That was the fake narrative. But at the last minutes, the new republic government pulled the rug from out of the feet of our military and signed this armistice and Treaty of Versailles. And it led to all of these problems that we now have. So there was this like laser focus on these, they actually referred to them as the November criminals, because the armistice was signed in November of 1918. They are the ones who caused all of these problems. And they need to be, you know, overturned, dealt with. So usually the way you attempt to combat those types of people, those governments that are in power, is almost always populist policies. We know where Germany was economically, and the big sort of piece of what was promised to the German people was work and bread, right? Everyone should have a job and everyone should be able to eat. And that's not like hyperbole. Like, people literally didn't have jobs and people literally could not eat, right? So these were very real things. So like, in public, they implemented all of these policies that were like the social safety net, building new infrastructure, the Autobahn, manufacturing, paid vacations for every German. That was like a real thing. Like, every German gets a vacation. Like, everyone deserves a summer vacation. So there were government funded vacations to other German towns, and that helped promote tourism and local economies. The Volkswagen model, right? Volkswagen was founded by the Nazi party, and they were copying the model of Ford Motors in the United States. This idea of every German should be able to own a car. And so they implemented this same concept of you pay in installments as part of your employment here. And eventually, in a few years, you'll be able to own a car. Entertainment and culture was sort of enforced, like this idea of like, we need to have a German paint style. We need to have a German film style, a German radio style. It was very much like everything had these nationalist undertones, and everyone gets a job. And that was very much a real policy. So that was what was happening in public. In private, the real economic mission of this Nazi party was a war economy. From the very outset, there was an understanding that there would be a showdown with the Western democracies. And in the case of these democracies, they were referring to, for sure, England and France, and possibly the United States. So all of those things that I described, those populist policies, which were really, really, like, everyone loved them. People started to have jobs. People could eat. People get vacations. I mean, you went from like your life savings evaporating for like being able to take your family to a vacation. In private, the reality of what those things were, like, new manufacturing jobs meant war machines, tanks, planes, ships. Infrastructure, the Autobahn, it was designed to move cars and civilians, but it was also designed to move troops across the country. They built out this air sports. Think of like the Blue Angels in the United States, was actually designed to train fighter pilots and build new types of fighter planes. Entertainment was propaganda. Jobs, and this is a really, really interesting one, this idea of every German getting a job, they accomplished this in a pretty extreme way. When the Nazis came to power, they arrested all of the labor union leaders. And so even though they were the Social Workers Party, right? So like the German Socialist Workers Party, they did not like the threat, the power center existing in unions, you know, other directions. And so they were not for workers' rights. And so what they did, instead of having labor unions to fight for workers' rights, they instead made it so that the responsibility of safety and workers' rights were left to the employer. So basically no oversight. So corporations became responsible for taking care of their employees. Unions were abolished, and small businesses were also made illegal. It literally became illegal for a business to exist without a certain level of capital, which meant that every German began to work for one large corporation or another. And what are large corporations really good for? War economies, right? So it doesn't help you as much to have a bunch of small businesses helping to fight your war, but it does. And a lot of these companies still exist today that have some weird origins, but a lot of them were founded around this time. And so that's how the economic policies translated to both this populism in public, but the underlying reason was to build a war machine that could be used to fight a war in the coming years. Yeah.
And one of the major characters in the book and in this story specifically is Hitler. understandably so. And so what are some of the tactics that Hitler used to solidify his authority and influence within German society ahead of World War II?
Yeah, it's really, I think, important to identify these things. One of them, there are the more obvious ones, and then there are the less obvious ones. So the more obvious ones are things like the private army that Hitler and the Nazi Party created even before they came to power. So when I say a private army, I'm referring to what translated in English to Storm Detachment, or the SA. The SA was a militia, sort of paramilitary fighting force whose job it was to cause chaos in the streets and intimidate political rivals. When I say like a paramilitary force, I'm not talking about like 100 guys. There are at its height about 2 million members of the SA, and most of these men are veterans from the war who fell on hardship and whose careers were destroyed, because not only did they lose the war, but it became illegal for the German army to be larger than a certain size. So most people, even if they wanted to continue a career in the military, couldn't. And they were, you know, in the throes of the Great Depression, and politics was radicalizing all around them. And so this became an opportunity to literally fight the people who they thought were, you know, who they were being told were the cause of all of their hardships. And it was a life and death situation. Their primary enemy in the streets of Berlin and Frankfurt and Cologne were the Communist Party. And I think people don't always realize just how powerful at this time the German Communist Party was. It was the second most popular party in Germany at this time. Even when the Nazis came to power, the Communist Party was you know, also extreme on the left, and they fought the SA in the streets. So these were like not political activists shoving each other around. These were like violent street wars with guns and shooting and death. Hundreds of people would die with each of these brawls. It would happen sometimes in the middle of the day. I mean, the closest thing I could think of to describe what I'm talking about is like, if you've ever seen the movie Gangs of New York, like kind of like that, where like you have these, these like, you know, radical, violent people killing each other out in the public. So that was happening all over Germany. And if you were a rival party, even if you were not one of the communists or one of the far parties, even if you were just like a social democrat, which is, you know, more of a centrist party at the time, every time you had a speech or a rally, the SA would just break them up. And especially when they came to power, when the Nazis came to power, they would refer to this as like a disturbance of the peace and just have, you know, 2,000 brawlers come in and start shooting or start fighting, start bashing people with, you know, weapons. And it became physically intimidating to anyone. I mean, think of like the average politician, right? How intimidated that might be. But even if you're like sort of a radical fighter for your cause, like, a lot of people died. So that was one way. There was another event that describes, I think, sort of the culmination of a lot of power consolidation that took place under the Nazi regime, which was done in what was referred to as the Night of Long Knives. This was an inter-party consolidation. So we just talked about what the SA was and how kind of brutal and useful as a political instrument they were to Hitler. Once Hitler began to rise in power and he had to start dealing with other power structures in the country, like the military, like corporations, like the president of the country at the time, who was more of a figurehead, but still very powerful. Think of them as like, you know, the King of England, sort of had that kind of power, right? And it doesn't run the day to day of the president, but is like a sort of designed to be above politics, but could still remove Hitler at any time. Hitler became the chancellor or like the prime minister, right? So Hitler's the chancellor. He's running the government, but is told by all of those other power structures, by the president, by the corporations who are funding him, by the military generals, that this SA crew that you have causing violence and mayhem in the streets is getting out of hand. And they're talking about all this crazy stuff like the SA taking over the military. You know, that leader that you have that you put in charge of the SA, a guy named Ernst Röhm, is like saying all these things about like a second revolution and overthrowing the generals and the military class. Like, you got to deal with those guys or you're out. And so Hitler was faced with this moment where, you know, you'd think he's like, oh, he's chancellor. He's in charge now. He's running the government. He still had a lot to lose. And so he did something in a single night that consolidated all of his power. And he did it by murdering all of the leadership of his own SA and thousands of those SA troopers. He either arrested them, had been killed, and it was all done in one night. And it was known as the Night of Long Knives. So that was like a sort of incredible dramatic story. The leader of the SA, by the way, was Hitler's best friend. And, you know, he had him killed. It was the only person that we know of that used the informal you. So in German language, it's sort of like in Spanish, like du und usted, right? In German, there's an informal du. And he was the only person we know of in writing that he used the informal du to Hitler and didn't refer to him as Mein Führer or anything like that. He referred to him as Adolf. And they were known to be very close. And they had him murdered that night to protect his own power. So those were like the pretty obvious ways. But then there were other, you know, sort of under the hood, less obvious things. And that had to do with those deals that were made with those other power structures, right? So I talked about why the Night of Long Knives took place, those deals with the military generals. In exchange for doing that, the generals agreed to say that, look, I know this president who's giving you a lot of heat right now, he's going to die soon. He's going to die in office. When he dies, we will support you absorbing the power of the president and we will back you as the military. So that was a way that Hitler was able to consolidate power, you know, quite literally. And then he made other deals with large corporations to fund his campaigns and all of the mass campaigns that he ran, both as chancellor for president and the various Reichstag elections, which is the parliament. With various elections to get more of the Reichstag to become Nazis. So lots of different, some obvious ones, some not as obvious, but quite a few steps.
And I think even what you just covered answers at least partially my next question, but I want to give you an opportunity to expand even more. Why were people just so unprepared for the men who instigated World War II?
Yeah, I mean, the Great War had only just ended. I mean, think about it. It was about 20 years after the war ended by the time the next one, you know, by the time when a lot of this was starting to take place. So, like, imagine if World War I happened in 2004, right? Like, that's how close it was to the people in the story. Most of the people were involved in the war. Either they fought in it directly, like Hitler did, and a lot of the SA and a lot of the government and military leaders at the time were all line soldiers or young officers during the Great War, or they were involved in it in some way. I mean, no one was unaffected all over Europe, right? It's not just in Germany. And there was this deeply embedded attitude of no war. We're done with war. It was literally referred to as the war to end all wars. So people thought, we're like, okay, we're never doing that again, right? Everyone must know that we're never going to do that again. And so there was this deeply embedded attitude of no war everywhere with everyone except Hitler, who saw war as an instrument to achieve his goals. And his goals were deeply radical. They were extreme. His goals were about, you know, a horrible racist, you know, ethnic cleansing that would take place that would lead to global conflict. The only way that an extreme, you know, power like himself, he believed, could grow to the state that he wanted it to be was through, you know, they knew they were going to meet resistance. And so to Hitler, this was a war that was going to happen one way or another. The question is, how prepared can we be in this window of opportunity before that war breaks out? So, you know, that was his goal. Now, why weren't people prepared for that? That's really on them, because frankly, you know, people didn't realize who they were dealing with, but it was all available for them to read. The book that Hitler wrote when he was in prison after he failed his first attempt at overthrowing the government, Mein Kampf, has all of this stuff laid out. It's all there. Now you can read it. All of his crazy backwards theories about race, all of his insane, you know, ramblings about unifying Austria with Germany and then taking over Czechoslovakia and then going into Poland and then going into Russia and then wheeling around and facing France and England. Like, literally what happened was exactly what, you know, Hitler expected to happen. The only thing that he didn't expect to happen was the World War to begin before he was fully ready. He believed that he was going to invade Russia first, invade the East, colonize the East, turn it into a sort of slave economy, and then use all of the natural resources and workforce from the East to fight the West. So, I mean, it was all written there, and it was all there in the 1920s. And if anyone had stopped and thought to read it, by the way, this was a widely available book. It was mandatory for every German to read. It was sort of like, there's not really a good example of it, you know, because we don't like mandate books, even though some are really popular. But you're like, you know, like in every hotel, there's a like a, you know, a Bible or something in the, you know, there was a Mein Kampf there, right? It was standard to give a copy of this book to like a German boy who was, you know, graduating school or something. It was something that you gave as a housewarming gift to someone who had just moved into a house. It was like the token thing. And, you know, not a lot of people actually sat down and read it, but especially the folks who were wildly unprepared for him, who had the power to stop him.
Yes. To introduce just a moment of levity, and because it's a funny story. When I was a young budding historian, I had asked for Mein Kampf as a book for my birthday because I wanted to, you know, read the story from the horse's mouth, as it were. And I got two copies. So I had two copies of Mein Kampf on my shelves for much longer than I think many people were prepared for. I finally donated the other copy. But yes, I agree with you. It is a fascinating read with that, having that historical context and knowing kind of what happened and how he effectuated his plan. But it is a wild ride to go through.
Yeah. It's not very well written. Also like, even if you were to like get a literary critic in here, I mean, it was mostly dictated.
Yeah.
And you know, anyone who's read like a transcript of Hitler in conversation with others, it's just like a rambling, like that's, it was just like, it's clear that that's what it was. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy how it's all there. So wild, pretty wild.
Yeah. And then in your analysis, what are some key indicators or warning signs that a society may be at risk for succumbing to authoritarian rule?
I mean, there's a few. I think if you're talking about democracies, there's a general lack of engagement, like a public cynicism, which can be very real. If there is a lack of a unified opposition to that potential authoritarian rule, that's a huge one. A lot of times ideological purity is like a test that certain political parties or political movements have, and those are valuable for certain things, but not valuable as it relates to opposing a larger threat. And in the case of Weimar Republic Germany, there were far too many different parties that did not unify against that common threat, and sort of left the and by the way, the threat did make deals with other parties, other nationalist, you know, right-wing parties. Even though they weren't Nazis, there were other right-wing nationalist parties that that the Nazis made deals with in order to vote as a bloc. And it was just not done on the opposition. When you see things like power consolidation, even if there are like small ones or civil ones, obviously things like desperate populations, willful ignorance of events that take place. There's a bunch of things happening in the world right now that are hard to understand or pay attention to because they're very sad or they're very difficult to internalize. But understanding what they are, or, you know, not doing so, is not the answer. And then, you know, all of those things together do not themselves always lead to rise of authoritarian rule, but sometimes things go sideways, and it's usually the catalyst that leads to that type of event, that that ground has been made fertile with all these other things that happen.
Yeah. And so there's, you know, knowing what the red flags are and being aware of those, and how can being aware and understanding these really help prevent the escalation towards conflict and tyranny and other bad actors?
Yeah, I mean, it only works if you're paying attention, right? And you believe that you can do something about it. And you always can. Think about, if you look at things like the Russian Revolution, right? In the Russian Federation today, there is so much cynicism by the average Russian, as far as, like, you know, Putin is more popular than I think Americans think to the average Russian, but he's not, like, you know, the second coming. And a lot of his so-called popularity with the Russian people has a lot to do with the fact that, well, what are we going to do about it, right? Like, there is this attitude of cynicism. But if you go back to the Russian Revolution in 1917, they revolted. And it wasn't just communism that, like, got everyone whipped up into a frenzy and overthrew the Tsar. It was about 100 years of buildup. I mean, if you read any, Leo Tolstoy, or, you know, this is a guy who was writing novels in the 1860s. And in his novels, he's talking about, like, oh, there's, like, these crazy socialists that are, like, have all these wacky ideas. And, like, what are we going to do about the serfs? Like, you know, like, they're having these conversations like 100 years before this happens. And so, like, there is all of this buildup that usually takes place. So if you understand these types of things as they're happening, you can usually get a sense of what might happen next. And there are a lot of people that are counting on your cynicism, so that they can continue to do what they want without a check on their power.
Yeah. Well put. And I think one of the things that amazed me the most was the level of detail and information that you had kind of collated for the audiobook. So you've done an incredible amount of research in putting this show together and then the book. What did your research process look like? And what is something you were surprised to learn?
I read so many books about the event, as you can imagine. So reading everything. And then I think once I had decided to produce something like this, from that point forward, I started reading everything and just taking notes as I went. I used my phone to take notes a lot, which was not something that I had traditionally done. I usually like to write stuff down on paper, but I used my phone because I knew I would always have it with me. And then I would do this thing where I would listen to an audiobook version of a book and then take notes while I was listening. So that was a huge part of the research process. From there, I would write a bulleted narrative. So this event and then like all the bullets that led to it, every time there was an interesting phrase or thing that was said or done, I would make sure that those things were documented. From there, I would like separate them into mini story arcs that became chapters of the story. And I developed this template for each chapter that was like, this chapter is going to focus on a single event, or a single like huge decision or moment. And I would start every chapter with right before that moment was about to take place. And then I would go back to the beginning and sort of lead back up to it. And then at the climax, you would get to that moment and then we'd sort of have a lesson at the end. Now, as far as what surprised me the most during my research, honestly, the thing that surprised me the most was just how close all of these terrible people were to failure. I mean, basically the entire time, every moment. And the chapters are kind of broken up in this way. There is a decision or a moment where power could have been used against these bad people to stop them. I think that it's easy for us to think about these terrible people like the Nazis as evil geniuses or like, the robots that, do all these terrible things and there's nothing we can do to stop them. The reality couldn't be further from the truth of that concept. In reality, they almost failed so many times. On the eve of Hitler being appointed chancellor by the president, which sort of solidified his rise to power, the Nazi Party was broke. They would not be able to run another election. They were at the end of the line. When the beer hall putsch was taking place, there was a huge moment where, the military police could have done more to stop them. When Hitler took over Czechoslovakia and the Munich Agreement, a lot of world powers and leaders could have walked away from that deal and said, Hitler, if you want to start a war, we're gonna fight one, and he would have lost. It would not have been a war that he could have won. And it would not have been as large of a war as it ultimately became. So there's all these times where things could have been done, where these terrible people would have failed. And I think I was amazed at just how many times there were, which is really the sort of message of this story. Yeah.
And switching kind of gears to putting stuff together. So this is an audiobook that started as a podcast. And so I'm curious, can you share what prompted you to move this from a podcast to an audiobook?
There was a lot I wanted to put in the original story that didn't make it. And once I published the work and started releasing installments of the podcast, I would constantly get questions of like, oh, what's the next one? Like, what are you going to do? And this took me 6 years to research, write, and produce. So, and now I have two kids. so like, it's going to be hard to do this again. And if I am going to do it again, because I love doing it, I wanted to see if there was, you know, anything here that I could actually, you know, turn into something. So I wanted to give a little bit more back to the listeners who did so much to support the initial release of the podcast version, and give them some new material, and some new content. And then I wanted to see if there was anything more that could be done here that could lead to, the creation of new stories, which I think there's no shortage of ideas around. And then I was lucky enough to sort of be discovered, during this, and we got some interest. So, that's how it turned into an audiobook.
Nice. And curious in terms of process. So you said, hey, this took 6 years to put together. So how did you flip it from, you know, building an audiobook, and how does that differ from putting together a podcast?
It was a lot more than I thought. I got the bulk of this done. I can just, you know, record a new chapter and some things here and there and flip it over. But no, it was a lot more work. There was a lot more production work. So obviously, I actually had the script, the new chapter already written. And during the original podcast miniseries, I decided not to record it. And there were a number of reasons why, but I never did. But I did have the script ready to go. But there was so much more to the script than I usually did before recording an episode. So I had to do all those things, put it in sort of a speaking voice, editing and producing all of the chapters into a brand new master track that was like 10 hours long, which is kind of crazy. Like, I thought my computer was going to explode a bunch of times. Removing things like intros and outros. I mean, those sound really small, but it's a lot of work, especially when you're dealing with, like, I think at some point I had like 12 or 15 tracks going at once, right? So like different tracks for sound effects, for music, for different layers of sound, different voices and characters, and it was pretty wild. So a lot more work than I thought.
And you stop your project at the start of World War II. So are there plans to have another iteration of how to start a war?
Yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of ideas. You mentioned how I stopped the story, I end the story at the start of World War II. And I think that we learn through failure and tragedy more than anything else. And so ending it where the war begins is sort of the idea. I mean, the last chapter is titled Catastrophe. And you know, the story is a tragedy. I mean, we know how it ends, but it didn't need to end this way. So that's sort of the message coming out of it. But I think that the next story would probably need to have a different lesson, and a different lesson would probably come from a different event and still be resonant to our world today. I think that's the key as well. So there's, you know, it's possible that I might just continue the story as is. But I think there's a whole human history worth of ideas to pull from. And I think there's no shortage of those ideas. But the success of this will directly lead to the next one.
Yeah. And where should people go to learn more about you and your show?
Yeah, you can download the audiobook wherever you get audiobooks, right? So Audible or Apple Books or Barnes & Noble. I think they're making CDs of it too.
The publishers,
Blackstone Publishing, which are apparently still a thing. Go figure. It's also going to be available in libraries, so you can go to the library if you're an audiobook reader. They have those free library apps that you can listen to as well. You can also go to howtostartawar.com, where you can sign up for updates and read more. And then you can follow How to Start a War Pod on Instagram.
And for the listeners out there, he does some really interesting reels, so definitely follow him on Instagram. And finally, as we wrap up, is there anything we haven't covered yet that you want future listeners to know?
a lot of the inspiration for the production of this work comes from golden age radio dramas. And I mentioned this in the introduction, but more often than I was read bedtime stories, I was lulled to sleep by a lot of these 1930s and 1940s radio dramas. So like Suspense and The Lone Ranger and all of these, even the comedy shows like Bones and Allen, they are a treasure trove of education for anyone working in the audio medium. So if you're a podcaster or a YouTuber and you want to learn about how to master a medium, I mean, these are fascinating. I mean, this was the peak of audio production. This was Hollywood level money going into the radio medium, the audio medium, and in a way that really hasn't been seen until, you know, we're getting it kind of today. But even now, we're not having, I mean, imagine if all of Hollywood disappeared and it was funneled into radio. That's kind of the level so you have all this incredible talent, and most of these shows are still available on YouTube for free. You can just watch them or listen to them, you know, through your YouTube channel. So definitely check those out, right? Like, look them up, find some clips, and you'll learn a lot in a very short amount of time. And then, like, last thing I'll say is, you know, people are capable of incredible change. And I think it's easy to feel dejected, but no amount of cynicism absolves you of the power that you have and the responsibility that you have to be the change that you want to see. And if you don't believe me, you can check out the book and tell me why I'm wrong.
Thank you so much. And yes, listening to the audiobook, I can definitely tell the influence of those 30s and 40s radio dramas. Very well put together. It was one of the most fascinating ways to enjoy history. So to my listeners out there, be sure to check out How to Start a War. It is one of the most immersive experiences into history you will encounter and provides a new way to understand World War II. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, friends, there you have it. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. And be sure to check out the show notes for the episode to find out more about Michael and how to get yourself a copy of his book, How to Start a War. Thanks, peeps. I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of Civics and Coffee. If you want to hear more small snippets from American history, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining me, and I look forward to our next cup of coffee together.